You have the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. It is 2021. It's a new season. I'm going to call this season two of the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm going to be bringing you in this episode a conversation with the one and only Tracy Brinkman. He is an expert on the entrepreneur mindset, and he and I are going to talk all things entrepreneurship, and we're going to learn from him in some of the valuable lessons that he learned from working from big time corporations like Coca-Cola. So get ready to learn about the entrepreneur mindset. Let's buckle in and go for a ride with Tracy Brinkman.
Hello, thanks for tuning into the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. The Upgraded Life is my personal project where I help people realize and reach their potential. I've been a professional helper for 20 years. Here's what I'm convinced of. The life that you have right now and the life that you want tomorrow is a product of your personal mindset, mission, and movement. Each episode of the Upgraded Life Podcast is going to give you something that you can do as soon as the episode is over to upgrade your personal mindset. Your mindset informs your mission. Your mission tells you how to move every single day. And together, that is the Upgraded Life. All right, I am here with Tracy Brinkman, and he is a podcaster just like I am, and his show is called The Dark Horse Entrepreneur, and I was just spending some time getting to know him. He's in Wisconsin. I'm over here in Oregon, so a little bit different time zone, but nonetheless, here we are, and he's got an incredible story to tell. He's done a lot of things with his life. And I'm not going to steal his thunder, but we're going to dive into some of those things. We're going to talk about what it means to be a dark horse entrepreneur. And then, as always, I hope to get his take on mindset and what that means and get from him some practical application of how we, how me, how you, people who are listening to this podcast, can upgrade their own mindset. So, Tracy, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm pleased to have you. And I'm going to throw it over to you. And just introduce yourself. Tell us about Dark Horse Entrepreneur and what got you started down that road.
Absolutely. Well, first off, thanks for having me on the show and the opportunity to, you know, share, to kick a little knowledge with you. The Dark Horse Entrepreneur for me is really kind of my way to give out to all those folks that are ready to, and I'm going to use the key phrase I use a lot, that they're ready to, you know, restart, kickstart, or just start, you know, upping their entrepreneurial game. And the twist I try to put on it, and as you alluded to, is that we always have to pay attention to that wonderful tool between our ears, which is our mind. I've been lucky enough across my time, and I shared a little bit of that with you, to have, you know, educated myself on, you know, thinking the right way. And I haven't always thought the right way. Trust me, yeah, I can go back to my dark days that I was alluding to, where, you know, I've been doing well. You know, I had done some programming. I started a programming business right at the beginning of the dot-com boom, really more right before it. And as it was going well, you know, I had a little coin in the pocket and started hanging out with the wrong folks and making bad choices. And I can say today that while I'm not proud of that, that I learned a lot, and it was me that made the choices, right? No one forced that bottle into my hand and made me drink it. No one put that powder up my nose, right? No one made me make all these bad choices. So sure. It's again, coming back full circle on the Dark Horse Entrepreneur for me, it's that way to help people get their businesses going, get them going better, faster, stronger, you know, little $6 million man allude there, but still focusing on the stuff between their ears.
$6 million man.
Right?
I was a little kid watching that show.
Yeah, you and me both.
what a blast from the past. So, you know, I love just that theme, right? Helping people to start something, get back to something, build up that confidence for that.
Right.
So is that element of dark horse, is that purely kind of from
the things that you've been through, or tell me more about the symbolism behind the dark horse.
I think the symbolism is behind it is really at some point in time, we all feel like that dark horse. And to me, the dark horse is the person in the race, or if you think about, you know, actual horse racing, the dark horse is that one that no one believes is really going to do it, right? Except maybe the person that owns that horse and is riding that horse, you know, so dark, and we all feel like a dark horse. Well, I say that. I know all of the folks I've engaged with have felt like a dark horse at one time or another, where they're like, you know what? I believe I can do this, even though maybe their spouse, their friends, their mom, their dad are like, yeah, yeah, you probably don't want to do that because, you know, and whatever we're hearing from the world around us, that dark horse symbolism for me is like, look, here, to all the people out there that feel like the world is, you know, the odds are stacked against you, you can succeed. And I'm here to share with you my stories and my tips. And then I bring on folks much like you do to share their stories and their tips, because you know what? I don't know everything, right? I'm at this level on my journey, right? I'm here maybe on number three, maybe you're at one or two, maybe you're at four, and you just need to be reminded of some steps you have forgotten. And then I try to bring on folks on the show that are further along. The folks who I want to learn from, you know, they're up here at 9 and 10 and 12, and so that they can share their ideas and their tips and their mindsets, thought processes as well, so that we can all learn. So I get to grow, and then I get to help my audience grow at the same time.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, there's somebody who has thought about what he calls his project. There's depth to it. Sometimes you run into these things and there isn't much depth to it because it was picked rather hastily and they ran with it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But Tracy, appreciate you having given some thought to that. And I think that's a great metaphor.
Absolutely.
It's a great metaphor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I think that we all can, if we're honest with ourselves, we all can align or relate to the dark horse metaphor, right?
Yeah. Even if it was just for a little while, right?
Yeah. Perfect. And then do the same, because this is another phrase, right, that gets thrown around a lot, but then we don't really, it loses some of its meaning, right? So mm-hmm. Entrepreneur, like what is that to you? How would you describe and explain that concept of being an entrepreneur?
You know, I think for me, being an entrepreneur is someone that's willing to start it off alone. And that may even be the solopreneur, but someone that has an idea that they want to get, they want to take to the marketplace. And the idea is going to bring some value to them. I shy away from associating entrepreneurs with those that take something that's already out there and just resell it. There's a level of entrepreneurship in that, but I think that's a low risk tactic, right? I think a real entrepreneur is someone that says, you know what? Here's a great example. I was listening to a show the other day, and he was talking about this gentleman in Australia, and he was into fitness. And he used a torsion bar, a tension bar from an APC. And for those who don't know military terms, that's an armored personnel carrier, right? So it was the tension bar that helped, you know, maintain the stability of the vehicle in the rear. So it's this big, long, heavy bar. And what he did is he turned around, he had a metal shop, and he went and he polished it up. And he put some a coating on it and put these rubber fittings on the end. And he used it he was in fitness, like I was mentioning, and he would go out to his customers and he created all these different exercises using this bar so that he didn't have to bring a bunch of individual dumbbells or kettlebells or all the different apparatus. He was able to do it with this bar. And then he created the same bar at different weights. So now you had maybe a 25-pound bar and a 50-pound bar and a 75-pound bar. So now he had three pieces of equipment versus all the weights and all the bars, you know, that would go with that. And now he's turned around and started marketing that. And for me, that's an entrepreneurial mindset. Like, he took something discarded, he added value to it by cleaning it up, polishing it up, putting the end caps on it, and then created ways to utilize that in his exercise practice. And now he's stepped away from being a fitness person teaching it, and he's just running his show, selling his fitness bars. Actually, he started selling them to the military, to the Australian military, and to the Pentagon. So, I mean, if that helps answer that question, it's like that person that takes something or either creates something out of nothing and add, or takes something that's already out there and adds value to it and then takes it back to the marketplace and says, hey, that's a cool whistle, but here's my whistle, and it does this.
Yeah, thank you for that. I love that. Sometimes it is something out of nothing, and sometimes it's repurposing something that somebody else wouldn't have thought of.
Right.
Yeah. Talk more about the other side, though, about marketing something that's already there. What does that look like?
I think if you're marketing something that's already there, so like maybe there are some shirts. Let's go with something simple like a shirt. All right, you got this nice striped shirt on with the collar, right? And there's a certain type of person that's that resonates with that shirt. So you're going to start marketing to that type of person. You're going to, you know, pick an age group and, you know, male or female, or maybe it's all. And where would you start to find those types of people that would wear that shirt? Be it, you know, and I'm going to pigeonhole here for a minute, be it on a golf course, right? Those, you know, that type of shirt is very popular on the golf course, a nice polo shirt, right? With a couple of button downs, you know, or if you have someone like me who's got, I'll call this the upgraded t-shirt with the little V slit in it, but it's all, the neck is all stitched in, you know, it's a little thicker than usual. So now you can say, all right, yeah, this is not just a t-shirt, right? This has got the venting, right? It's got this nice, it's a double layer material. So now who's going to be gravitating towards that? Which probably your more casual person like myself, and where are you going to find him at? You're going to find him out there working in his yard. I could still work out, and I've seen lots of people do it, work out in the yard with the polo shirt, but you know, now you got to start working the, you know, playing the odds. So it's taking something and finding the key factors that people like you or I would be focused on when they're in that search. Just, you know, putting those out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's more about finding the person who's going to like what already exists.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I like that. And you sound like you may know a thing or two about marketing and the retail biz.
Yeah, I've been playing in the marketing world a long, long time. I make it sound like a prison sentence. I worked for Coca-Cola, who's to me one of the kings of marketing, for 14 years. I spent some time working for Home Depot and in their online section in the early days, and we were connected with marketing on a daily basis. And then for the rest of my career, I was always integrated or a part of the marketing processes and in the marketing engagement, whether that be, you know, Frontgate and Crandon Road, Victoria's Secret, a David's Bridal, La Senza, or most recently, Legendary Whitetails. And it's been cool to learn the different aspects of marketing that they do. And like if you go down to one of the things we hear so much about in the marketing world is to niche down, right? And when you're a Coca-Cola or a Home Depot, you don't have to worry about niching down, right? Because you're Coca-Cola. And even a Home Depot can do that. You know, they have their niche. They have their DIY niche. But when you're dealing with someone like, say, like a Legendary Whitetails, they took their niche all the way down to who their guy was. And I say guy, even though most of the shoppers were their wives. They focused on whitetail hunters. Right. So, and they really drilled down, and for whitetail hunters, you're talking about the Rust Belt of the United States. So mainly the Midwest and then up into parts of Pennsylvania. And they did very, very well for a number of years. And when they went into Amazon, they started seeing some good sales. But when they cracked into the Amazon world and really started working in the digital space, their product resonated with other folks. And so they had to break away from the mentality of, I only want to market to whitetail hunters. But they wanted to be true who they were. So what one of the strategies they took was in their messaging on their website, that's who they focused on. We're going to stay true to who we are. We focus on you, Mr. Whitetail Hunter. But in their outwardly more digital landscape, they were more focused on those outdoorsmen, all right, those outdoors folks, because a lot of their gear, a lot of their apparel had camo piecing in it. You know, they had nice polo shirts with, you know, camo piecing going down the sleeves, you know, maybe the deer right here. You know, they had nice t-shirts that were double thick and just very warm that had, you know, outdoor imagery on it, be it the woods and fog or a deer, you know, walking through, you know. So a lot of folks that resonated with that, I like the outdoors. And you know, there was other urban folks where just the camouflage factor was a cool factor. So now they really cracked into a bigger market. And then in those not their website, in their the other digital spaces, they started marketing to that message, and they grew exponentially super fast as a result.
But that was all still staying true to their core, right? I mean,
yeah, they stayed true to their core. When it came to their website, they kept producing the product for their core audience. Mm-hmm. They were just lucky in the fact that they were able to produce a product that, in doing that, resonated with another, you know, outer. You look at it like this: here's your core audience, and then there's another outer ring just outside of that of folks that are similar. So you have your, in their case, the hunter. Well, I'm not a hunter. All right. I like their product, but I like hiking in the outdoors, and I like camouflage piecing in my gear, be it my board shorts or my shirts, you know. So then you've got that, and then you could have even another outer layer of folks that are a little less similar, but still resonate with that same thing. Like I mentioned, maybe some of the urban folks that, you know, board shorts, surfers, where camo is in. So now they are able to ride that wave, no pun intended, for a while.
Yeah. So one thing that you said there that I've embraced in, you know, the projects that I have going is this idea of, you know, niching down, right? And mm-hmm. What does that mean? And I've got a book in the works called Guru Speak, right? And so that's going to be one of the chapters, right? And so I'll do some name dropping. So you and I are both connected through Zachary Babcock in Underdog Empowerment. That's how we connected. And I just did an awesome interview with him a couple of days ago. And, you know, he pitched his mission, which is, you know, a world where you don't have to pretend to be somebody that you're not. Right. And I think that matches that idea of niching down.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got connected to Zachary through a coach of mine that I had hired named Bradley Grinnan, and he runs the Coach Launch. You can find that on Facebook. And then through him was Nick Peterson. And then through Nick Peterson is where I got connected to Zachary Babcock. And then you and I are connected that way. But Bradley teaches the same thing about niching to problem and not necessarily to a person or an avatar. And that really kind of spoke to me as well. And so what you just described there with Legendary Whitetails is, okay, so we're always going to do right by the whitetail hunters, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of our core gear and what we're about and our angle. We're not going to produce things for waterfowl hunters or, you know, dove hunters, but it's, at our core, it's going to be whitetail hunters, and we're going to do that better than anybody else. And because we stayed true to that, then everybody else sees that. Everybody else sees that authenticity, that passion, that dedication. And then that's ultimately what's attractive to people, regardless of whether or not they're a whitetail hunter or not. What do you think about that?
I totally agree with that 100%. I think, and it applies to just about anybody that you come across out there sharing a message, is that you can feel that authenticity, right? I don't know, maybe it's the vibe they send out or the words they use. There's something about it that resonates with you and you click. And so that, for me, authenticity is a big thing. And that was one of the things that attracted me to Zach as well, was the fact that he just is who he is, right? He pulls no punches, right? And that comes with everything that goes with that, good, bad, and the ugly. And if that resonates with you, then you and him will jive and you'll get a lot out of it. And if it doesn't, it's all cool. It's right. It's no skin off his nose. There's plenty of other folks out there that who are still authentic and will resonate with you in a way that you're are very accepting of, if that makes sense.
Sure. Sure. So I'm curious, you know, through all of those, well, I mean, let me talk about another thing too. And this is kind of turning into maybe a marketing 101 discussion, but that's fine.
That's okay.
You never know where this will turn to, because again, it's all related to mindset at some point in time. But you made the statement, which is absolutely true, about, you know, Coca-Cola and Home Depot, they don't have to worry about niching, or they don't have to worry about, because they already know, right? They already know. And if you think about Coca-Cola, it's been around since 1892,
I believe.
What was it again?
I think it's 1892.
Right. Okay.
So it's been a while.
They've probably figured out who's drinking Coca-Cola and who isn't, right? And
yeah.
Right. And the things that they had to do in 1892, because I'm familiar a little bit, you know, with all the times they had to consider, you know, formula shifts and, you know, all that type, you know, but that's over 100 years ago, right? I mean, they figured that out almost 130 years ago.
Right.
So all the grind that's associated with somebody here and now in 2020, trying to figure out who they are and what they do and who's going to like it and who's not. Coca-Cola did the same thing. They just did it a long time ago.
A long time ago. Yeah. And there, and you know, and I say that they don't have to worry about it, but they do. In some sense, I mean, they still focus on it. They still make sure that they attract their core customer. A great example of that is while I was still working with them, they keep their branding, their messaging. They have a very solid outline of, you know, what you can do within the Coca-Cola sphere of things. And there was a lot of, they do a lot of hiring of new marketing folks, you know, fresh out of college. And so these folks are just hungry to cut their teeth, which is really great for an organization like Coca-Cola. So they get all these great fresh ideas. However, a lot of them, because they're coming from these younger, hungry minds, are a little more edgy than the Coca-Cola brand wants to be. And so Coca-Cola went out on a mission to find a root beer brand. This was, I think, back in the 90s. And they wanted to bring on a root beer brand. A, it was a good product, but B, already had some imagery behind it that was a lot more edgy, so that they could use some of that marketing expertise in that world. And they ended up bringing on the Barks brand.
Yeah, Barks.
And, you know, the Barks has bite. Yeah. And so right out of the gate, when they took that over, they started doing some great media in marketing campaigns that were a lot more edgy than Coca-Cola. So now they could be true to themselves as Coca-Cola, even though everyone now knew that Barks was owned by Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stay true to grandma over here, you know, our 100-plus-year-old legacy. Right. We're going to keep them nice and solid, as sturdy as a rock. Over here, we're going to play and have some fun. Right. And it really worked really well. They did the same thing with their Surge product that was out for a while, which was a citrus-based product. And it was I don't know if you ever remember any of the commercials. I mean, there was one commercial that stuck in my head. It was like a couple of kids in a hoopty car, and they were out on a dirt road, and they were doing donuts, and the camera was kind of focused on the can just kind of sliding back and forth across the dashboard, back and forth past the camera. So not something Coca-Cola themselves would have ever done under their flagship product, but certainly with these other more youth oriented products, they were able to go there.
Sure. Flagship marketing was polar bears and Disney and those types of things, right?
Yes, very solid, very, very grounded, very core.
Right. And Coca-Cola is ain't nothing like the real thing. Is that one of their taglines?
Ain't nothing like the real thing. Yeah, yeah. The real thing. And different. There's been different versions of it over the years. Yeah. And there was the Always campaign, Always Coca-Cola.
Right. And then they all Pepsi and Coca-Cola went with the clear, and that just nosedived.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was just a fad. Everyone was trying it, you know. And I think one of the cool things for anyone that's, you know, on the outside looking in, I think everyone understands that or believes that Coca-Cola is number one. And I'm talking from a market share perspective, right? And then Pepsi's number two. What's really funny about that is when you say that in numbers, it's like, okay, well, they're running neck and neck. Well, not really. Of course, my data is probably a little dated at this point. The last time I looked at it, you know, Coca-Cola maybe had, you know, 13-26% of the market share. And then Pepsi, you know, had half of that. So for Pepsi to reach number one, it would take a monumental effort, mm-hmm. you know, but just the perspective of being able to say you're number one, but I'm still number two, still gives them that leverage against everyone else.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's as common of a conversation starter as anything else. Coke or Pepsi, Chevy or Ford, you know, so it's
exactly
there, right.
Yeah. I had a lady come up to me and ask me for, you know, my drink order, and we were sitting at a restaurant, and I said, "Well, I'd like a Coke." She goes, "Well, can I give you Pepsi?" I said, "Can I give you Monopoly money?" Anyway,
yeah, too funny. Yeah.
Luckily, she took it in jest.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'm fascinated by. I mean, you've kind of been in the belly of the beast, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Being exposed to what these mega corporations and how they think and how they operate, what they say about their customers and their consumers, mm-hmm. right? And so give us a you know, for example, and I don't know how true this is. I'm going to take it from the Spurlock movie, Supersize Me, right? But supposedly McDonald's refers to their customers as users, right? And mm-hmm. according to how frequently somebody goes to McDonald's for a meal, it will determine, you know, if they're a light, moderate, or heavy user, right?
Sure.
Is that making sense? So, like, you know, Coca-Cola, Home Depot, like, how do they refer to their potential buyers and customers?
You know, the word I always heard was a consumer.
Consumer.
You know, and then, you know, in some circles, you know, it was a drinker. I think one of the interesting factors that a Coca-Cola gets to do is they're not always marketing for the consumer. A lot of times they're marketing for the people that pour their product, which is the McDonald's and the Arby's. And, you know, so they're, some of their campaigns are just pretty bells and whistles that these restaurants, you know, restaurants and chains can put up in their establishment to help market the Coca-Cola product. And one of the tools that like McDonald's will use in the upselling is the fact the price point of their cost price point on a Coca-Cola product is far less than most of us understand. Huh. The average Joe doesn't realize, you know, the pennies that right. McDonald's pays to pour a large product that you're paying, you know, nowadays, what, a buck and change for, mm-hmm. they're probably making a buck on sure. that. So when they say, would you like to, you know, upsize to a large, well, then they've just made an extra dollar on you. So now you could count the number of people at any one restaurant and imagine the coin that comes with that.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, yeah, that's a great point. And I didn't really realize that, you know, that it's more about helping the people that pour the product. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's a, you know, a marketing strategy that I probably wouldn't have even thought about it until you just brought it up, right? That
yeah, and it's a really a brilliant one, because one of the tactics, and I mean, I think entrepreneurs can take a huge lesson from this, is one of the tactics that they use is they create marketing products, right? You know, I'm talking about the patio the patio umbrellas that you see out on the patio in front of, you know, Joe's Subs, right? We've seen all the Coca-Cola ones. And they create a whole line of stuff. And then depending on how many gallons a year you pour, you get X amount of marketing dollars. So you get some of that stuff for free. And then you can buy additional pieces at a cheaper than you're going to go to Amazon and get it, right? Because they're producing it in just massive numbers. And we were bringing over containers of patio umbrellas with the Coca-Cola branding on it. And so, you know, getting a 6-foot umbrella, for less than $50 was unheard of to anybody else, but, you know, yet all my restaurants were getting it like that. So, you know, coming up with a campaign that you could sell to someone who's going to turn around and sell it for you, you know, you could call that kind of an affiliate marketing kind of version, but the Coca-Cola's going out to the restaurants, that's exactly what they're doing. They're selling their product to someone that's going to turn around and resell it, you know, and they're making sure that person reselling that product is as successful as they can be, because that's how they get their success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, another insider look on that, right? That's a brilliant strategy too, because if I'm a restaurant owner, maybe I'm just, or a franchise owner, right? There's a part of me that's apt to hit that incentive level, whether or not, you know, it's bringing up my bottom line or not, right?
Right.
Yep, I want absolutely. 6 more of those umbrellas, damn it. And I don't want the guy next to me or gal next to me to beat me. So, you know, pour more Coke. That's a brilliant strategy.
And if it fits with your image, you know, having, you know, those Coca-Cola umbrellas out there are great eye catchers, right? You know, you got the guy that's across the street that you're competing with. If he's just got plain white or, you know, just some, maybe just his brand, you know, hey, it's Fazio's, whatever. But you've got this nice, you know, big, huge with all the colors, you know, and then yours lasts a couple of years because, you know, Coca-Cola spent the money to make sure it lasts because they believe in their product. Sure. It's a win-win.
Yeah. And then this will be a kind of like a no duh question, but I'm going to answer it anyway or ask it anyway. So when somebody does that, when somebody decides to bring on a brand like Coke, then they are also benefiting from all of that work that Coca-Cola has done. And so, you know, again, the messaging around the real thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, then that automatically is being subconsciously, subliminally implanted when somebody's choosing to go to your restaurant because they see Coca-Cola, they know it's the real thing. And then that's parlaying into their decision to go to that restaurant. Yes, no?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. It's like you and I, you know, when we bring someone onto our show, you gain a little of their status along with them coming on your show. So, you know, we're always trying to target that next level up person because that helps you level up your status. And then, you know, you're learning from them as well. So it's a symbiotic relationship. Absolutely. Yeah.
So Tracy, you and I have been having fun with this conversation, right? But we both have growing audiences.
It's been good chat.
And that person, that guy or gal, may be listening to this like, what in the world are they talking about? How is this going to help me? So let's try to do that. Let's try to break this this conversation that we've been having about Coca-Cola and what they do and branding and marketing and brand sharing. I guess that's a term. I don't know if that's a real term out there. And break it down for the person who is just starting out. Like, what can they learn from this?
I think one of the things they can learn is, and I scratched on it just briefly, is things like, I'll go to the easy one, affiliate marketing. So if you know, it's like, dude, I have this killer product and I know it, you know, let's say, I'm going to charge $97 for it, but it's really worth $970. It's got 10x value in it. Yeah, sure. You can spin your wheels and, you know, and grind away and put out the Facebook ads and the Google AdWords and all those great marketing tactics to sell your product. But if you can get a team of folks, much like the Coca-Cola to the restaurants, that is selling your product for you. So now you just say, hey, I'm going to charge you, I don't know, $40 for it or even $30, because if they have a number of folks that they engage with on an ongoing an ongoing dialogue, they could turn around and sell far more copies than you had been selling by yourself. I know there are places like JVZoo where you can sign up to, you know, offer your product out. But I think one of the key things is finding someone that would believe in the product with you that has an army behind them. That would be one tactic. That's one way you could take this Coca-Cola selling to McDonald's, McDonald's selling to the consumer. At the same time, Coca-Cola is still selling to the consumer. So you can still keep selling your product as you normally would, but now you have this handful of people that are reaching out to their network of folks and saying, hey, this product by Tracy or this product by Nick, it's pretty damn cool. I've checked it out and maybe they've even used it. Heck, sure. Even send them a free copy of it and let them give it a shot, you know, because their word, you know, if I send it to Nick, Nick's like, dude, before you even got me on, you know, on an episode, you're like, yeah, Tracy sent me this thing and it's awesome. Here's what it does. Boom, 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 boom. We're going to be bringing him on here in a couple of weeks and we're going to chat with him about that. You know, so now there's nothing more magic than that kind of word of mouth coming Absolutely. Through someone.
Yeah. I love that. And I'll share a concept that I'm working on, much the same idea, but recent, I'm part of a different mastermind called the Dad's Edge, and Larry Hagner created that about 4 or 5 years ago. And I did an episode with him that folks can see. I think it's episode 31, but it's a group of guys that pay to be part of this mastermind. And the goal is to help fathers live legendary lives. And every month we go through some kind of content. We call the, you know, our tactical agenda. And so we have individual call teams, and every month, you know, a group of guys are coming together, you know, virtually through a Zoom link, and we're going through this content, and it's all related to, you know, being better men, being better fathers, and all that kind of jazz. Long story short, I had the opportunity to create some content that mm-hmm. was going to be used for the tactical agenda. And my background is, you know, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I have a PhD in counseling. I've been a helper in the professional helper for over 20 years. And so kind of my mission right now is to figure out how to leverage that in a way that, you know, speaks to a larger audience. So I created mm-hmm. Kind of my take on what I call anger resolution for the content. Versus anger management. And I won't go into that here. I've already did an episode on that, I think. So,
okay.
Mastermind went through it. And then where I get stuck, Tracy, is I've also worked in corrections for 20 years, youth corrections.
Okay.
And so when you do that work and you do it well, it requires you to be very experienced in a lot of different things that people have problems with, whether it's addiction, whether it's self-esteem, anger, mm-hmm. you know, different types of problems that come with your offense type. And in order to do right by those young people, you kind of have to know all those different territories and then, you know, stack on 3 college degrees. So I'm legitimately an expert in a lot of different arenas. And that's part of my problem. It kind of stalled me out. Like, what do I do? And what do I put out there? And anyway, sure. I gave the group, you know, the leadership group, here's 4 things that I'm prepared. I can whip up content, no problem. And they all said anger resolution. I said, perfect. Okay. I did that. About 400 men went through that program. And then the feedback that came through was just overwhelming in a positive way. So that's my project. That's one of the things I'm going to push forward, is getting my anger resolution out there. But just like you and I were talking about, one of the ways that I'm going to do that is get it in the hands of people that already have an audience, that already have an mm-hmm. email list, right?
Yeah.
And so they can push it to their networks. And that's going to be way more effective on the front end than me trying to do Google AdWords and Facebook exactly. ads. And
yeah. Yeah, I think so many folks, you know, they take the time and, you know, they have the expertise, you know, maybe not the expertise you have, but they take their expertise and they put it, you know, pen to paper or, you know, video or whatever medium that they use, and that's their baby, you know, so they want to say, I put all the blood, sweat, and tears into this, you know, I deserve to give everything back. Well, yeah, but it's not going to do you, your audience, any good unless they start to engage with the content, and you got to get it out there. And trust me, when you start putting yourself out there, new things are going to start arising. Sure. New doors are going to open and new opportunities will present themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that mantra that I keep repeating on this show is that, you know, action is superior to intellect, which I got from Nick Peterson. And it's so true, right? Because if I hadn't had taken action, I would have never known that anger resolution was the thing that resonated with so many guys around that.
Sure.
So, Tracy, I know that part of what you do is you help the dark horse entrepreneur get their product out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for people that are listening to this, because I know my show has a lot of fledgling entrepreneurs or people who are looking to escape, you know, whatever their current job scenario is, right? But if right. For that person who's listening who says, yes, the idea of being an entrepreneur is appealing. I want to do something different in terms of how I'm using my time, but I don't know what to do. I don't know where to start. Where is square one for you when you're working with people who are representing the dark horse and entrepreneur situation?
I think a lot of times it's getting to know what their core skill is. I personally believe everybody has something they do super well. The challenge often is the person doesn't even recognize it because it's so easy for them. And a lot of times it's so easy for them. They're like, isn't that easy for everybody? And I've been victim of that. There's been a number of times I had someone come to me and say, man, you do that so, so well. You need to teach me how to do that. I'm like, what, you don't already know? You know, so I think that usually is the first challenge to overcome is to identify that one or two skills that they have that could bring to the marketplace and offer a transformation, let's call it, just, you know, offer that 10x value that I was mm-hmm. mentioning earlier. And once you can uncover that nugget, it serves two purposes. One, they're able to speak with that authenticity that we mentioned earlier. And two, it's coming from a place inside them that they're clearly very passionate about. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken the time to learn to do it so easily.
Sure.
So now they're speaking with on that authenticity and that passion, and the people receiving that message, it begins to resonate with them and click. It's almost like, you know, it's just natural. It's mm-hmm. just there. So now it becomes easy for them to do the thing that they're right now struggling to do.
Sure. Yeah. And there's been, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, examples of what you're talking about, where somebody, it doesn't even really even have to be a skill necessarily. I mean, I guess it's always a skill, but right. you look at the people that did well with their blogs. I mean, there's blogs on all kinds of topics that you wouldn't think anybody would pay attention to, let alone pay for. And they do, because
right.
you know that that subject, you know, matter. I have a friend at work who is, he's like a Boston Celtics encyclopedia. I mean, he knows everything there is to know about the Boston Celtics in current, even current, you know, team and whatnot. And I just keep thinking, man, you could start a YouTube channel or a blog and just put your knowledge out there. And within a matter of time, you would be, and he doesn't believe it.
He'd have a huge following. Yeah, absolutely.
And he just doesn't get it. So I like that piece about square one is doing this kind of no judgment attached assessment of yourself, right? Mm-hmm. What are you good at? What lights your fire? And no judgment, right? Just start listing it out in terms of those things.
And I think one of the things to ask yourself is whenever you're given a project, and I'll use the phrase project for lack of a better one, what's the first thing you start doing with it, right? And some, you know, a lot of us have different processes that we go through, right? The reason I'm even thinking of this is because I was just speaking with a young lady, Yasmin Vorji, and she's got a best-selling book out called Big Results in Tiny Time. And she was working with a coach when she was made redundant in corporate, I almost say corporate America. She's in Ireland. So from the corporate world. And she decided she was going to go out on her own versus find another corporate job. You know, honest. She wanted to build something around what she values, and that was her family. But when she hired a coach, as they were going through, you know, some uncovering of things, her coach, you know, made her aware of the fact that whenever that Yasmin was very good in getting some things done the easiest way possible, the most efficient way possible. So she, that's where she focused, because that was like her, that was her core skill. Hey, I know how to get this done easy, quickly, and fast. Right? That's okay. That's two things at once, right? But you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So that's what she's built her whole mantra around, her whole coaching experience. And the book she wrote is all around how to get things done effectively and quickly at the same time. I mean, she her angle that she's taken on with that is how to have a great business in 20 hours a week or less.
Awesome.
So she's not going after the 4-hour work week like Tim Ferriss, but she she's using that same type of marketing that we're now used to as a result of the popularity of Tim Ferriss's book, and saying, hey, you can have a great business in 20 hours a week or less.
Yeah.
And I think to me, or maybe to you, a mind like mine is going, okay, that is very believable. If I, because I know if I took out all the noise and I only did the absolute necessary task, I could probably bang that out in about 20 hours, mm-hmm. right? So now, how do if she has a process for that, well, let me check out this book kind of thing, sure. right? And then if that resonates with you, well, then you can, you know, take a course or, you know, hire as a coach. And so that's, it's finding that core little skill. And again, someone may need to point it out to you.
Love it. Love it. And that's an episode that's already up for you, or is it coming soon?
Yeah, it just came out. It just landed this morning, as a matter of fact.
Awesome. Awesome. So you release shows on Monday morning?
Yes.
Yeah, me too. That's my pattern as well. So I just want to highlight a couple things there. One is, you know, a lot of what you said, and I'm not trying to, you know, make a comparison here, but are you familiar with Ken Coleman and the sweet spot concept?
No.
So Ken Coleman is he's a guy out there, has a big audience, but he talks about how, what stalls people out when they're on this entrepreneur type of a thing. And basically he draws two overlapping circles, and mm-hmm. one circle is what you're good at, right? And the other circle is what you're passionate about. And it's the overlap there is your thing. The one, he wrote the book called The One Thing, or The One Question. I can't remember. One Thing, I think, was Keller from Real Estate World. But, and I think he'll say that a lot of times people will have some skill that maybe they learn. Like, I mean, you learn some tremendous retail skills that mm-hmm. you probably are good at, right? But if you're not passionate about it, then it's right. It's only going to go so far.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely.
Or you can be really passionate about something, but if you don't have the skill for it at this point in time, again, it's only going to go so far in terms of what you're going to be able to do with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's something to be said also for those folks, and maybe it's just outside that sweet spot. So maybe they're really passionate about it and they're okay at it. Mm-hmm. Well, if they're willing to be completely vulnerable, they can take people along the journey, right? Hey, I'm not good at this. I'm okay at it, or whatever this happens to be, but I'm willing to take you along the journey, because everyone out there, there's someone that doesn't do it as well as them, and there are many people that do it better than them. Sure. So those people that don't do it as well, they want to learn from this person. And then, you know, if you can be authentic and say, look, I'm gonna put myself out here. You're coming along with me. I'm on stage 3. There's probably 23 more stages to go that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. And we'll travel this journey together, and we'll make wrong turns and whatever.
Right.
And we've seen folks that are doing that as well.
Sure. And you're touching on another kind of, you know, universal truth for an entrepreneur or maybe I'm calling it a universal truth. Maybe you'll say it's not. But you talked about how, you know, at the front edge of being an entrepreneur, you're by yourself, right? And mm-hmm. that's where the term solopreneur comes from. And there's going to come a time to where for you to reach whatever the next level is, you're going to have to bring on a team.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And sometimes that team is, you know, maybe you are passionate about it, but you don't have the skill, and maybe you find the person who has the skill and bring them on, right? Share the vision with them. And now you've just shored up, you know, your skill deficit just by bringing on a team member.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's well, I'm going to reference another episode that just dropped this morning. I dropped an episode, a solo episode, where I give like 21 tips for entrepreneurs.
Love it.
And one of those tips is, you know, find good people. And in that tip, I talk about those, you want to find the people you want to be like, right? So there's the saying out there that you are who you most hang around with, right? So if you're hanging around with, you know, guys that are hanging out at the bar and, you know, and wasting their day away, well, then that's probably what you're going to result. But if you're going out there and you're engaging with people that are trying new things and pushing their boundaries, then you're going to travel that path with them as well. So find those good people. And then a couple of tips later was, you know, higher values. And so you can teach skills. Right. So if I'm going out and I'm looking for a copywriter, I want a copywriter whose values align with the message I'm trying to send and with who I am as a person, because he can hone his copywriting skills even better. He's probably not going to change his values overnight. Right. Sure. And so if he's a shady person, well, I don't, you could be the best copywriter in the world, but if you're shady, I'm sorry. You and me aren't going to click, right? I have a value in there, but no shadiness allowed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hiring the right people in, if you're taking the time to find good people to hang around with, finding the right people to join your team, it's a whole lot easier because you can tap their network of folks to say, hey, I'm looking for this copywriter, but I need to be good at copywriting. But man, I don't need any sleazy guys. I don't need someone that's going to be, you know, one of those, what do they call it? Snake oil salesman, right? kind of writers. Right. And they'll say, oh, you need to talk to Nick because he's got this guy we were talking to, and I know he's probably in the market, yeah. You know? So those two kind of, you know, work really well together.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. And that's go check out that episode, folks. You know, 21 things,
21 tips for aspiring entrepreneurs.
Love it. Love it. One last thing, and then we'll jump into my famous question, getting your take on mindset. You know, but the other thing that you mentioned just a little bit ago is, you know, most people will come to this point in their entrepreneur journey or whatever. It doesn't have to be an entrepreneur journey. It can be a lot of different things where you just have to humble yourself and realize that you need help. And mm-hmm. The time that you can save and the money that you can save by hiring a coach is huge. And agreed. So many people just don't get there. They think it's ridiculous. If it's going to work, if it would work, I should be able to do this. And they don't ever kind of get to that kind of place of humility and say, I need help, and I need help from a coach. And literally weeks, months, years can be shaved off, whatever it is, you know, your journey is ahead of you. If you would just, you know, bite the bullet a little bit and pay for somebody to help you. And then, mm-hmm. you know, the excuse is why I can't afford it. And more times than not, you can't afford not to. Meaning, what would it mean to shave off 3 years off of this process? You know, you can't afford not to do the effort to make sure that happens in your process. Your thoughts on hiring a coach?
I totally agree with that. I think having a coach, a mentor, whatever, you know, tag word we want to put to that is invaluable. I've been lucky enough over the course of my 40 plus years in the workforce of having a number of coaches that have taken me along a path, either paid or just said, you know what, I'm going to take you under my wing, you know, via some sort of mentorship program. And they had a number of those at Coca-Cola and Home Depot. But the lessons that you walk away from, you're just like, oh, wow, it would have taken me 20 years to learn that, or I wouldn't have learned it for another 10. And now I know it now, so I can start. You know, I was lucky enough that I had such an awesome mentor that there was a period in my career at Coca-Cola that I got promoted 4 times within 5 years. And it was just by working with this coach and instituting the things that were going, you know, that he was teaching me. I'm like, good God, give me more, right? I just became ravenous as a result. And it was amazing. So yeah, having a coach, I'll never downtrod that. I know one of the gentlemen I've been paying attention to, Jamie Atkinson in the podcasting world. He has made a pretty good, a very good name for himself. One of the stories he tells is about how he invested $30,000 in himself over the course of a couple of years. And as a result of that, he ended up, going to big events and end up speaking at, I think it was, oh my gosh, the guy who, Russell Brunson, he ended up being a speaker at one of Russell Brunson's events because he had invested himself and he was taking, and this is the key to that, and I think you'll agree with this, investing yourself with a coach, but then listen and take action with those learnings. And because he was doing that, people were seeing the results he was getting in the podcast sphere. And that's when Russell Brunson invited him to come speak on stage. You're on Russell Brunson's stage, you're talking to folks that are making bank every year in the digital world. So that really got him exposure and paid him back that 30 grand of investment pretty fast.
Absolutely. And for the folks who are listening who don't know who Russell Brunson is, what's he famous for these days?
ClickFunnels is his big, that's his big product. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. I've been following Russell since, good gosh, I think it was probably mid-90s, early 2000s when he was trying all kinds of cool things. And he's not an overnight success. I think a lot of folks will say, oh, wow, look, he put out ClickFunnels and he's an overnight success. Now, this guy, he's been cranking away at it for about maybe a decade and a half.
Right.
I don't want to exaggerate too much, but he has been working hand over fist. He's been busting away at it.
There is no such thing as the overnight success.
I agree.
Social media will convince you otherwise.
Yeah. And I think anytime you hear of an overnight success, if you just take a couple of minutes and do a little research, you'll find that they have been working behind the scenes for a long time. And maybe this one thing that they just finally got into the public eye is, rising, pretty meteorically. But in the meantime, they themselves or they and their team have been cranking away for a long time. I know the Melanie Perkins for Canva, Canva seems like it hit the ground running. And in, two or three years, it now has a $3 billion valuation. Mm-hmm. Well, what people don't know is the story where she had a product called Fusebox that she had been selling to high schools for, I think it was close to a decade when she was like 19 years old. So from 19, she cranked away and cranked away. And she's in her early 30s now. And so she's been working at it, a couple of decades as well.
Sure. Absolutely. Canva, this little thing right here came out of Canva. So a very, very powerful application out there that I'm absolutely pro subscriber to. So yeah. Thanks for demystifying that. That there's these, like you said, if you just spend a little time looking at the backstory, seldom is, very rarely, if ever, is the overnight success what social media makes it out to be.
Yeah, very true.
What's really there is somebody who had an idea, had a passion, and took action, right? It's that taking action piece of it. Even if you fail, John Maxwell says his secret to success for himself and when he coaches other people is teaching them to fail as frequently as possible, so that way you can learn everything you need to learn in a short amount of time, and then success is on the other side of that.
Absolutely. And I think that just comes back to the value of having a coach or a mentor is that they've already gone through a lot of those failures, and so you get the experience of not having to repeat those exercises and just do the ones that are, in your realm of the unknown.
Right. I was listening to a podcast, Fraser Brooks. His world is network marketing, and he had a gal on, and she made this comment that something that works, most of the time is great. Something that works every single time is brilliant in terms of whatever your product or whatever your thing is out there. And that really kind of resonated with me, the difference between being great and brilliant.
Yep.
Tracy, I've been having a blast talking with you. We could probably go on for the rest of this day, but my
probably right
won't endure that at this point in time. So hopefully we can reconnect and do another show and jam on something different. But as I always do, I ask my guests to give their take on the concept of mindset. So what does that phrase mean to you?
The phrase for me is, it's a pretty big one, and I'll tell a brief story and help your listeners understand why. About halfway into my career, I was blessed with my second daughter, Krista. However, she was born with an issue with her small bowel. Generally, when you're born, you have about two, and I'm going to use round numbers here. I'm not a doctor. It was like 200 centimeters of what she would normally born with. She had like 1/10 of that. She had like 20. Mm. So she didn't have enough small bowel to sustain life. So over the course of the first 3 months of her life, she went through six different operations where they, you know, did things from installing a TPN line that would feed her the nutrition she needed to trying to, you know, dissect the intestine and reconnect it together, make it longer. And all that to say, they got her stabilized. However, you know, because she has this TPN line, which means she wasn't having to process food the way you and I would. So her liver, the body brain being the brilliant thing it is, said, okay, well, you don't need this liver. It started to deteriorate. So now she needs a liver and small bowel transplant. And, you know, we get her on the organ donor list, and we wait and we hope. And so mindset at this point in my life is really a tricky, you know, it's like a minefield. If I step on the wrong way, I'm going to get this negative mindset. And so I have my first daughter who I'm trying to keep, you know, a positive, you know, exoskeleton around, you know, saying, okay, they're doing the best they can, yada, yada, yada. And in the meantime, I'm out there talking to anyone who would listen to me, and probably a few folks that didn't want to listen to me about the topic of being an organ donor. Fast forward, she's 18 months old, and unfortunately, she's taken a real serious downturn. And I pulled the doctor aside, and I asked a tough question, a question I didn't want to know the answer to, but I needed to, is if you had the organs right now, would she survive the operation? You know, and it seemed like the whole world stopped as I was waiting for that answer. And he gives me a little doctor speak, and I literally, no joke, pulled him into a janitor's closet and said, look, it's just you and me, dude. And I re-asked the question, and I finally get the answer. He felt no, that, you know, if the organs were available right now, she wouldn't survive the operation. Okay, got it. Not the answer I wanted, but so the next question becomes, do you think she will get better to be able to survive? And again, the answer was no. So now the question I have to ask, right, is do I keep her on the respirator? And for me, and this is a personal decision for anybody who would have to be faced with this, is it would have been selfish of me to keep her here. I would be keeping her for me, right? So I could look at her, so I could talk to her. I decided not to be selfish. They disconnected the machines, and literally I sat down in the rocking chair and I rocked her to sleep one last time. And during that, I shared with her all the things she had taught me in the 18 months she had been here, you know, how to look at life through different eyes and experience things for the first time. And coming out of that, and I can say that now because I've, you know, reflected on it, it was a big mindset shift for me. You know, my life hadn't been bad. I've been doing good things, but I had been missing a lot of things because of the mindset I had going on between my ears of, you know, oh, I don't need to pay attention to that, right? It's like, and I missed so many things that were happening around. So I think, I say all that to share that mindset is huge, and every experience you go through can help you further polish your apple, right? Even the bad ones, the most horrible, I would not wish that event to happen to my worst enemy, right? Mm-hmm. But because I was able to walk away with the mindset that she taught me valuable lessons, she was here for a reason. Now I need to go forth and, you know, honor that and share with those that are willing to listen, and maybe a few that aren't willing to listen, you know, what I think about, you know, mindset. And that kind of puts it into perspective how important I think mindset is.
And so a big piece that I heard in there was, you know, when things happen, the good and the bad, the trap is to be selfish about those things.
I think that would be definitely be the trap, is that if you just say, I just want to learn what I think I need to learn. Oh, no, you're going to have to open yourself up. You're going to have to be vulnerable, be willing to cry, be willing to think, oh man, I'm a dummy, right? Or whatever adjective you want to put right there. I shouldn't have done that. I made a bad choice. Yeah. And stop going, you know, pointing the finger outwards. Oh, it's because of the economy, or because of my spouse, or because of this, or Joe across the street, or, you know, that guy on that podcast. No. It's because of the things you did and the things that you're thinking and allowing yourself to continue to think, right? It's the same thing when I talked about being on the dark side of the tracks, right? I could have, after they kicked the door into my condo, I could have said, well, you know, that was a bad day. I'll learn from that by being a smarter criminal. Right? No. I decided, no, I wasn't going to be a criminal anymore. That was my wake-up call, much as losing Krista became a wake-up call to the things I was missing in life, the joy and some of the pain, right? Because, you know, you ignore things maybe as a filter, right? A purposeful filter. It's usually because of some experience you had going back in your life. You would know that way more than I would, you know, given your career path.
Yeah. You're doing great. So for the folks that are going to pretty soon hit stop on this podcast, because it's going to run out, and what can they do? Because what I hear you saying is, like, look, life's going to throw things at you, right? Yeah. And ultimately those are things that you need to learn from for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. Am I catching that right?
So far, so good. Yes, yeah. Sir.
So how would somebody who is listening to this podcast, after they hit stop, how can they start embracing that mentality, that mindset of learning from the things that life throw at us that we don't even wish on our worst enemy? How does somebody get up to that? Mm-hmm.
I think the first one would probably be, if there's something where you're saying it's their fault, that would be the first thing I would probably say they should attack. I know I spent time coming out of a bad marriage where I spent a number of months where I said, it's all her fault, and here are all the things that she did bad, blah, 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 blah. But now, you know, when I sat down and started thinking about it, it was like, okay, well, you know, I wasn't the angel in the relationship. You know, I did some stupid things and I made some stupid choices. So I think that's the first thing. If I speak from my experiences, anything where you're saying it's their fault or it's someone else's external fault, just sit down and you know, reflect back on that. Is there a choice that you made along the way that you might make again that you shouldn't make? That's just an education. Okay, now that can help. Lift up your mindset and say, all right, well, that happened as a series of these things. Da, 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 da. And inside those things, here's where I was part of the plan, part of the process. And how now, if you really grasp onto that, you can alter those things from happening again.
Love it. Love it. Perfect. Way to tee that up for us, Tracy.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Dark Horse Entrepreneur, where can people find you? If this message resonated with them, where can they connect with you out there in the interwebs?
They can find, probably the easiest way would be to go to darkhorseschooling.com, just like it sounds, darkhorseschooling.com, and all the socials are there, you know, the links to the podcast. If they wanted to search for the podcast on any of the major players, you know, Stitcher, Apple iTunes, etc. Like you said, it's the Dark Horse Entrepreneur. We're now 12 episodes in. I think only three of those are solos. All the rest of those have been bringing other folks like yourself on to share their stories and their knowledge as well.
Perfect. And folks that are listening, for people in the podcast game like myself and Tracy, go over and subscribe, leave 5-star reviews, actually go in there and type a review. Those are all things that help us get our message out there. And I believe that Tracy has a message that needs to be spread far and wide. So if this is something that, like I said, resonating with you, go over there and do something as simple as leaving that 5-star review, typing in a sentence or two about what you liked about Tracy or the episode, and that pumps up our metrics.
Absolutely. Sure does. Thank you, Nick.
All right, Tracy, I wish you well. I wish you well with all of your projects. And I thank you again for taking the time and being on the Upgraded Life podcast.
All right. I thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Well, there you have it. Another fascinating, insightful, and super fun conversation with a pretty good guy. I just enjoyed spending that time with Tracy Brickman. He brings a wealth of knowledge to the topic and discussion of being an entrepreneur. His podcast, as you probably just heard, is all focused on the entrepreneur mindset. So I strongly encourage folks to head over to his podcast, check him out, and do us both a favor. Leave us both reviews on Apple Podcasts. Leave us 5-star reviews and type in a note or two. It's really both of those things that you need to do to help us out. You need to leave a 5-star review, and then you also need to type a note in as a written review. And that just helps the world know that this is a podcast, both mine and Tracy's, that people ought to be tuning into. So both of us would greatly appreciate that. If you want to connect further with Tracy, as always, check out the show notes. And in order to get to the show notes, you go over to my website, www.nicksotelo.com/TUL podcast. And when you get over to my website, you're going to see all the links that are necessary in order to connect further with Tracy. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking in another episode. And, you know, one of the biggest ways that you can repay me for the time, effort, and energy and sacrifice that it takes to continue to put these episodes out is to apply something that you learned just now. You just spend an hour investing in yourself, treat it like an investment, and apply something. Execute on something, do something so that you can realize and reach your true potential. And if you did that, let me know. Send me an email, hit me up on social media. Just let me know, hey, that episode with Tracy Brinkman helped me buy this. And because of this thing that I learned, I am now doing this, or I am now able to do this. That is big time encouragement, big time momentum for me to know that folks that are taking the time to invest in themselves through this podcast are executing on the knowledge. This has been the Upgraded Life Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo, urging you to realize and reach your potential. We'll see you on the next show.